Well, Moonlight Sonata, Deafness in Three Movements, is a deeply personal memoir about a deaf boy growing up, his deaf grandfather growing old, and Beethoven, the year that he was blindsided by deafness and wrote his iconic sonata. In the studio, I have the film's director, Irene Taylor-Brodsky, also the producer, Taria Sheether, and this is really just a very different and amazing film. So welcome and thanks for being here on the Sundance Reel.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Irene, tell us a little bit about the film. I mean, an extremely personal one, I'm guessing, for you.
It's actually the second memoir I've done. The first one I did was about my mother and father and premiered here in 2007 at the festival and won the Audience Award. And I swore I would never make another family film again, but apparently things changed. My son started to go deaf just a few months after that festival that year. And so began a long, slow, new saga of documenting his childhood.
Okay. So tell us just how all of this then works. I mean, and how Beethoven is brought into this.
So my son wanted to play the Moonlight Sonata. It was his choice. And as I learned about this film and read Beethoven's letters, I realized that he wrote the Moonlight Sonata during this watershed year in his life when he accepted that he was going deaf. There had been a number of years leading up to that. He was very private about it. He wouldn't tell anyone that he was losing his hearing. He was afraid of losing commissions and work. And finally, he went into a suicidal depression, and he wrote the Moonlight Sonata coming out of that depression. So it's a very melancholic piece, and we wanted to tell the stories of three deaf people across 300 years. And the sonata has three movements, so the whole film is structured around the movements of the sonata.
Interesting. So it's a genetic, obviously, hearing loss in your family?
It is. It skipped me, though. So my parents have it and my son have it. And part of the film goes into the genetic etiology of the deafness in our family.
So it's fascinating to watch your son and the interplay between him and his grandparents, just how he kind of accepts his deafness in a completely different way, I think, than they do, which I think was interesting. There was, you know, a component of it where you see this in Here and Now, where that's really a journey about them regaining their hearing through these cochlear implants, whereas your son gets one kind of earlier on. And I'm just kind of curious, you know, there's... you see in the film, you explore kind of the silence and the beauty and the kind of the world of being deaf, and then, of course, the world of the hearing through the music. And there's a part of the film where your son takes off his implants and just plays with no, you know, because mistakes don't matter. He can't hear it. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was just so beautiful, of just kind of the metaphor of just letting go and just relax. Does he still do that? I'm just curious, like, where has he gone? He seems to be so passionate and obviously very talented at playing the piano, but kind of how he accepts, you know, certainly being hearing, but also kind of the beauty of silence.
My son's 13, and like any teenager, he tries to duck away from his parents, and he turns off his implants a lot now. But I'll tell you, I think he learned in that film to take off his implants more and more because he looked at his grandfather, and he knows that he has this superpower. We call it a superpower because he can just turn off his implant at any time that the noise of the world is bothering him. And, of course, don't many of us wish we could do that?
Yes, it's like the ultimate meditation. You're like, I'm in my cone of silence.
Yeah.
So there are some lovely animated scenes in the film. Why did you decide to incorporate the animation?
Yeah, well, very early on in the production process, we were brainstorming how are we going to represent Beethoven's story in a way that, you know, every viewer can connect with it, and in a way that's new. You know, Beethoven's life is one of the, Beethoven as a composer is one of the most well-known composers. So how do you tell his story anew? And so we really liked the idea of using animation to bring the viewer into this 18th century world, 19th century world, and to allow the viewer to connect with Beethoven in a different way. And so you'll see in the film that the animation is woven throughout. We sort of dip into animated vignettes that punctuate the different themes in the film. So there's not a lot of animation, but we really tried to be very deliberate and strategic about where it appears and the arc that it creates throughout the live-action footage.
All right. So, I mean, as producer, what was your role in all of this?
Well, you know, I think producer, documentary producer, can mean a million different things. In this case, really, it was Irene and I the whole way through. We were the two steadfast rocks of this film, and we wore not only director and producer hats, but editor, assistant editor, production assistant, associate producer hats, you know, as is the nature of documentary producing.
Taria also, as producer, had another role as the field sound recordist, which is a very important role, of course. And if you look at some of the most famous Verite documentary film teams, you know, the director sometimes would run the camera or run the sound, and the producer would run the other. You know, they ran the sound and the camera together because it allows for fewer people in the room. And if the director and the producer are both in the room for all the footage, then you really have a different relationship, a much more intimate relationship with the footage.
So it's interesting because it's your family. And I have to say, I usually watch these films because my job is to exhibit films. So I usually am, you know, completely immersed in a film and all the reviews before I actually see it, which kind of, in some ways, ruins it because you have everyone's opinions in your head. So for Sundance, I usually watch it cold without having really a lot of information on it. So I didn't actually know you were the director. And suddenly I'm watching, I'm like, oh, wait, so it must be interesting to document your own family because are you just always filming? I mean, that would be your inclination, right? That you wouldn't, maybe Taria's not there and you're like, ooh, good moment. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's got to be a challenge of when do you turn it off?
That definitely happened. We just had a run and gun kit, camera kit that could get turned on at a moment's notice. And we had it right in the house or right next to the house where our working studio is. So we definitely needed, this film depended on being able to turn the camera on at any time. And, I did not narrate the film until 3/4 of the way through the edit. So in other words, Tari and I, with our editor, Bill Weber, we all edited the film together. And we created an entire film that had no narration. So we wanted the film to be rooted in the scenes. And we wanted it to play as much like a narrative feature film without that notion of it being real. We wanted scenes to play as though there were dialogue back and forth and the proper, you know, angles for that. And then we used the narration really just as a guidepost. You know, I was your guide that took you through things that might not have been clear. But wherever the scene could tell the story, we wanted to back away.
It is kind of meditative quality to it, which makes sense how you're describing it. I lived in Portland, Oregon for a while, so I came to realize, oh, it's in Portland when you see the swallows, you know, that very famous.
The swifts,
when they're going up the chimney. And it's this thing in Portland everyone goes, right? It's like this big thing. But it's just, I like how you interwove kind of parts of everyday life of just and how that it is this kind of continuing journey, that there's kind of a rhythm to it that seems very natural and kind of flows and draws you through, as opposed to it being a little bit more, I don't know, kind of heavily structured.
Well, and Tari was talking about the birds. You know, I think with the animation, we felt that the bird was the right icon for Beethoven because he's a bird of a different feather, if you will, who flies away from the flock. But he also, he is this poetic analog. In music, that's what music does. It sort of cradles us, and it crescendos and decrescendos. And that's sort of how the bird moves through the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you definitely get that. The music is unbelievable.
Yeah, and the fact that your son's at a pretty challenging age. So, I mean, was he cooperative? I mean, it would have been a lot different had he been 8 or 9 years old as opposed to 12 and 13.
Taria was indispensable because not every boy wants to talk to his mom. So why don't you talk about that?
Yeah, you know, you did a couple of interviews with him, but I really did a lot of interviews with him. And myself and our director of photography, Nick Midwig, Nick was really instrumental as well because Nick, you know, says that he was one of the boys, you know, one of the three boys. But, you know, we have hours of footage of Jonas squirming in a beanbag and sucking on a lollipop that weren't usable. You know, he is just an everyday 11-year-old boy. But it was really about finding those moments when he was open to talking to you. Because if he wanted to be playing video games, I mean, that's what he wanted to be doing. So
Lots of Altoids.
Yeah, we could have never made the film now with a boy who's 13. I think for any parents who are listening, you know, you really can appreciate the difference between the openness of a 10 and 11-year-old child And when they start to be a teenager, they really turn so much more inward, and their inner life becomes something more sacred and protected. He was at this age where he just was an open book, you know, and if he didn't want to do something, he didn't do it. But he had a personality at that point, and he had enough intelligence that he could verbally spar with his teacher for some funny comical moments in our piano lessons. So I feel we got really lucky that Jonas was 11 when he wanted to learn this piece, because if he wanted to learn it when he was 13, we would not have been able to make the film we got.
Yeah. But you still get the sense of him being, he's a kid.
Oh, right. Totally.
But I love these scenes where there's a couple of scenes where he's with his grandfather, which is so beautiful, where he's kind of being a pain. Mm-hmm. And at the end, you know, he signs, "I love you." Walk away, yeah. And you're like, oh. Like, there's just that moment. There's just, like, that little kid still there, right? Where even though he's kind of being annoying, you're still like, yeah, I still love this kid.
Okay. Well, you've got a couple of more local screenings. And we should mention that the film is in closed captioned as well.
Yes, the film, mm-hmm. We have made a very, very detailed closed caption signal. We love it when our deaf friends come out. So it will be closed captioned at each of the screenings. Yep.
Great. And they have lots of ASL interpreters on site this year. They said last year they had maybe 3, and this year it's over 30, which I thought was pretty amazing. Yep.
All of our Q&As will be interpreted.
Great. Again, so the local screenings here Friday, the 1st at 4 o'clock at Redstone Cinema 2, and then Saturday the 2nd at the Park Avenue Theater. And any news on where else this film will go besides Sundance?
Well, we're going to have a long festival run this year, and HBO has acquired the film, and they will be putting it on HBO probably in 2020, the year of Beethoven's 250th birthday.
Nice. Perfect.
Okay. The film is Moonlight Sonata, Deafness in Three Movements. Ladies, thanks for your time this morning.